On this edition of Celebrating Science, Ed Witten on the quest for a unified string theory. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, The Quest for Supersymmetry, Ed Witten discusses the progress made in connecting previously independent superstring theories and how this work may lead to a single, unified theory that explains all the forces of nature. Professor Witten is a world leader in superstring theory. He is the author of hundreds of scientific articles and has won many distinguished prizes, including the Einstein Prize and the Fields Medal.
So I'm going to be explaining to you today what particle physics is and what particle physicists are trying to do. And the first idea I want to convey is that we don't study the particles because we like particles. What we really care about are understanding the laws of nature, the laws that are at work in biology, chemistry, and astronomy, in basically everything we see around us. And the name particle physics comes about because understanding elementary particles has proved to be an important part of this. Basically because many of the laws of nature are most visible in microscopic processes involving the elementary particles. If you want to see relativity and quantum mechanics and the weak interactions, for example, all at work at once, you basically have to study the elementary particles. So that's what gives this field its importance. So let me explain more fully the idea that if you want to understand the laws of nature, you have to understand the particles. Take something we see in the world around us that at first sight doesn't seem to have anything to do with particles. Around us we see waves, let's say light waves. But according to quantum mechanics, if you look more closely, the waves are made of little packets of energy, which are called photons. And then the photon turns out to be one of the most important elementary particles. So phenomena that in the 19th century did not seem particle-like turned out to belong to the world of the elementary particles. Matter, when studied more closely, is made of atoms, and atoms are made of protons, electrons, and neutrons. And when you look more closely, the protons and neutrons are made of smaller things called quarks. The quarks and the electrons are as close as we know to something which is indivisible. They may be divisible, but not at a level we understand now. And they are some of what we regard as the elementary particles. How did this tale get started? Well, early in the 20th century, Ernest Rutherford discovered the atomic nucleus in a famous experiment in which he bombarded atoms with energetic particles. Here's the atom, here's an incoming particle, which actually was an alpha particle. I think this peculiar symbol is a manifestation of what was meant to be the Greek letter alpha. the theories of the day claimed that the atom was like a little ball of jelly. In came the energetic alpha particle. He thought it was like bombarding a bit of jelly with a speeding bullet. It would pass straight through. He was surprised to see alpha particles scattered at large angles, not just this angle I've shown here, but even larger angles, 90 degrees and more. And he interpreted that to mean that inside the atom, there was a hard object that he called the atomic nucleus. So the very beginning of understanding the structure of the atom came with that experiment where the atom was found to be not a little ball of jelly, but to have a hard object, a nucleus inside it, and ultimately to be understood as a little miniature atom, a little bit like the solar system, with the nucleus surrounded by electrons. That understanding came from the first high-energy scattering experiment of elementary particles. Now, as I just told you, Rutherford was surprised when his particles were sometimes scattered at large angles, showing that the atom contained a hard nucleus. To make this discovery, Rutherford did not need any method to accelerate the particles that made up his beam. It's lucky he didn't need it because he didn't have any method. There weren't any particle accelerators. He used a natural radioactive source. So his alpha particles were created by radioactive heavy elements. I'm not sure what he used, but it could have been uranium or any alpha-emitting atom. He had radioactive materials that naturally emitted alpha particles. And that gave him a source of a beam of particles that, from the point of view of the day, was a very high-energy beam, and it was adequate for discovering the atomic nucleus. So the energy of his particles was very large by the standards of chemistry. The alpha particles in Rutherford's beam had an energy of about 1,000,000 electron volts, which is 1,000,000 times the energy of an electron that comes from a 1-volt battery. If you've got a 1-volt battery or any reasonable battery, each electron coming out of that battery has an energy of 1 volt or a few volts, while Rutherford's alpha particles had an energy 1,000,000 times greater. So a 1-volt battery is what you can make with chemistry. Chemistry will give you particles with an energy of a few volts each, but radioactivity gives you particles with 1,000,000 volts each. 1,000,000 electron volts is abbreviated MeV, and the next one is a GeV, where I guess G stands for giga. That's an abbreviation for 1,000,000,000 electron volts. Rutherford's experiment was done at about the same time that Einstein was learning that E equals mc squared. So another way to describe what's an MeV or a GeV, instead of comparing them to the electrons that come out of a battery, is to say that an MeV is about 2 times the rest energy of an electron, and a GeV is the rest energy of a proton. So Rutherford used particles in his scattering experiments whose energy was bigger than mc squared of an electron, although it was still much less than mc squared of a proton. The next one is a TeV, where T is for tera, and that stands for 1,000,000,000,000 electron volts. We'll get back to the TeVs a little bit later. Now, a lot of important discoveries about the universe were made at energies of roughly an MeV. Radioactive sources in the lab are not the only naturally occurring sources of high-energy particles. High-energy particles also reach us from outer space. They're called cosmic rays. And one of the first big discoveries made using cosmic rays around 1930 was the existence of antimatter. So cosmic ray particles reaching the surface of the Earth included electrons. That wasn't a surprise because electrons had been discovered in the laboratory around the end of the 19th century. But what was a surprise, sort of, was that the reason I say sort of is that it actually was predicted by Paul Dirac based on theory just before the experiment. But to everyone who hadn't bought into Dirac's theory, what was a surprise was that the cosmic rays, along with the electrons, also contain new particles called positrons that are like electrons, but they have opposite electric charge. The positron is the antimatter equivalent of the electron. The way the discovery was made was that the particles reaching the Earth were allowed to travel through a magnetic field. And a charged particle in a magnetic field will make a spiral motion, which I've tried to convey here, perhaps not very well. This is meant to be the spiral motion of an electron in a magnetic field. And so that was observed as expected in particles reaching the Earth from cosmic rays. But it was found that there were particles that spiraled at the same rate but in the opposite direction. So they had the same mass as the electron but the opposite charge, and those were the antimatter cousins of the electron, the positron. So that was certainly another big discovery that was made with naturally occurring high-energy particles. Now, apart from having the opposite charge from the electron, the most basic property of antimatter is that matter-antimatter pairs can be created and annihilated. So I've tried to sketch that here, And this is a picture where you might think of time as running from left to right. The wiggly lines, first drawn that way by Feynman, represent photons propagating through spacetime, quanta of electromagnetic waves. And here we imagine two very high energy photons, and that's as close to pure energy as it gets, which are converted to electron-positron pairs. You can also run the experiment backwards. You could have an electron and a positron, and then it will annihilate, they'll annihilate into pure energy, or more precisely, into photons, which I've actually sketched here. So here, time is running from left to right. An electron and positron come in, and they annihilate into photons. So if you travel to a distant solar system and meet an antimatter friend, don't shake hands. So there's still, in our time, are important discoveries made with naturally occurring particles. So what I've drawn here is a picture inside the so-called Super K Observatory in Japan. It's in a rural area of Japan, which I actually visited a couple years ago, which was fun. I'd only been in Japanese cities before. It's filled with a tank of extremely pure water, and the walls are lined with these enormous phototubes. They're hard to see here, but they're detectors for detecting visible light, actually. They're just extremely sensitive photon detectors. And these are physicists, probably graduate students, going around in a boat, checking the phototubes as the thing is being filled with water. And when it was filled with about 50,000 tons of extremely pure water. Extremely pure, so that a particle interaction inside the tank, creating a tiny spark of light, that light would travel through tens of meters and be picked up by the phototubes. Water of average properties isn't so transparent, and also would have radioactive impurities, which would mess up the experiment. So it's filled with extremely pure water. And what they discovered was what's called the mass of the neutrino. So one of the important elementary particles is the neutrino, which was long believed to be a massless particle like the photon. It actually turns out to have an extremely tiny mass, which is very important in modern theories that try to unify the forces of nature. And to discover it, it's best to use neutrinos that have traveled thousands or even millions of miles, which are naturally produced either by the sun or in the Earth's atmosphere, and which were then observed in this laboratory. So not just 100 years ago, but down to the present, important discoveries are made with naturally occurring particles, naturally occurring sources of high energy particles. I have another picture, but this one is meant to convey another idea I gave to you, which was the idea of particle, antiparticle creation. So this is a picture from a particle detector at the Rick Laboratory in Stony Brook, in Brookhaven. And two nuclei came in. The particles came in along this axis. So the region where the particles came in is blocked out. But literally thousands of particles came out in all directions from that collision. That's possible because of the way energy is converted to matter and antimatter. And here's another, this case is, I think, a more scientifically important event. It has a more manageable number of particles. Again, the high energy particles came in along the beam. And I told you a little bit about what antimatter is and how it was discovered originally with naturally occurring sources of high energy particles. Another strange discovery made in 20th century physics was quantum mechanics, which is perhaps the strangest of all. In the quantum world, everything is fuzzy. If you know where a particle is, you don't know how fast it's moving. So I've tried to make a little picture of this. In this picture, time runs vertically and space runs horizontally. And the wiggly black line is meant to be the trajectory of a particle moving through space. And classical physicists imagined that that trajectory was absolutely perfect, that at every moment in time, suggested by this blue line, the particle is somewhere, here at this time, and up there at a later time, and that it had a definite trajectory in space. But quantum physicists learned that there's an inherent fuzziness in those ideas because of the quantum uncertainty principle. If you know where the particle is, you can't know its energy, and vice versa. And this was a discovery that changed a lot of our understanding of the universe, But for my story today, its important implication is that it implies that to discover something small like an atomic nucleus, you need a probe of high energy, like the radioactive beam used by Rutherford. So Rutherford's beam had a high enough energy to enable him to discover the atomic nucleus. And as I explained already, nature provided us with other examples of high energy particle beams that were used to make other important discoveries. So many discoveries were made using the natural sources of high energy particles, but because of the uncertainty principle, to get farther, physicists had to make artificial accelerators to reach even higher energies. In an accelerator, charged particles, which usually are electrons or protons or their antiparticles, which are the positrons and antiprotons, are accelerated using electromagnetic waves. So I'm going to give a kind of very primitive version of how you get started accelerating particles. So the crudest version, and the version which is inside an old-fashioned television set before the modern era of condensed matter displays, which are on, for example, this screen of the laptop. But in traditional television sets, there's a filament, a hot filament. Electrons are boiled off initially with low energies. They're attracted to a screen which has a positive charge. So they're attracted electrostatically. And they're accelerated to a certain energy that depends upon the charge you can tolerate on the screen without getting yourself electrocuted when it undergoes a catastrophic discharge, grounding itself if you didn't let it ground. And actually, you can reach energies that are probably comparable to the ones that Rutherford had with his radioactivity. And then once you create this beam, you can manipulate it with magnets. The crudest version I've drawn here is simply a stationary magnet at North and South Pole. And it'll bend an electron, a high-energy charged particle, and that lets you start steering the particles. And if you're skeptical that there's an accelerator inside your old-fashioned television, and you have a television you're planning to throw away, you can test this by bringing up some magnets. Just use some strong, ordinary magnets, and interfering with and perhaps ruining your screen by the influence that the magnetic fields will have on the charged particles that were accelerated inside it. Don't use it with a TV you're not planning to throw away. You reach a certain energy this way, but there's a limit here. If you use static electric fields, then to get high energy particles, you would need very strong fields, and you will eventually get electrocuted. So to get to higher energies, people then invented devices using time-dependent fields, oscillating electromagnetic waves. And that makes it possible to get to higher energies. But there's still a limit to the fields that you have, and therefore a limit to the energies you can reach with a device of a given size. So because there is a limit to the strength of the fields that we use to accelerate the particles, to reach higher energies, you need a bigger accelerator. And that's why accelerators eventually become quite large and expensive. This is the beam pipe of an accelerator which is at the Brookhaven Laboratory on Long Island. And the particles are inside here, along with the magnets and the devices creating the electromagnetic fields that are used to accelerate and steer them. And this is a particle detector. I think it's from the laboratory in Japan that studies the differences between matter and antimatter. If it were operating, the particles would be entering here. Here, the detector is being refitted, probably. But when it's operating, a beam pipe like this one, which accelerates and steers the particles, would go down here. And then inside this device, the collisions occur with particles coming down a similar beam pipe on the other side. The particles that come out of the collision are then detected in these devices. And well, to get a scale, this device here is presumably a foot or two tall. So it's a big device. So by inventing artificial accelerators, by the 1960s, electron beams with an energy of a few GeV were available. I remind you that a huge EV would be a few times mc squared over proton, and it would be about 1,000 times the energy that Rutherford had. So Rutherford discovered the atomic nucleus with energies of an MeV. By the 60s, we had energies 1,000 times higher. And the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics means that you can therefore see 1,000 times smaller. So Rutherford was able to look at the atom and see that there was something hard inside it. But the experiments in the 60s repeated the story, not with an atom, but with an individual proton. So you might think that physicists shouldn't make the same mistake a second time. But anyway, in the early 60s, the view of the proton was that it was a soft object like a ball of jelly, like the view of the atom had been in Rutherford's day. It wasn't quite as silly as it might sound, because there were some experiments that appeared to support the jelly picture of the proton. Some experiments at lower energies fit that picture well. But when GEV electron beams were available and electrons were scattered from the proton, it was found that sometimes the electron was scattered at unexpectedly high angles, and meanwhile, a lot of stuff came out. In Rutherford's experiment, what came out was pretty simple. But in addition, he probably wasn't able to observe it. He really only observed the scattered alpha particles. Here, because of the magic of matter and antimatter, rather complicated stuff came out at these energies. The electron was scattered by a large angle, and the proton seemed to break up into fragments, including antimatter pieces. So again, one discovered that there was something hard inside the proton, and that's how quarks were discovered. Rutherford had discovered that the atom contained a nucleus, and 60 years later, with higher energies, it was discovered that the proton contains quarks. So here's the modern picture, which emerged from this experiment and other later ones. The proton or neutron is made out of three quarks, plus things called gluons that keep them together. So the proton has two up quarks and a down quark. For the neutron, it's the other way around. The quarks have fractional charges. Minus E is the charge of the electron. And in those units, these are the charges of the up and down quarks. And if you work it out, you'll see that the neutron is neutral, and the proton charge is plus E. So the proton and neutron contain the up and down quarks. But altogether, there are at least six different kinds of quarks. The first particles containing the strange quark are another example of an important discovery made with naturally occurring particles. So particles reaching the Earth's surface, but created in the upper atmosphere by cosmic rays reaching us from deep space, were the first particles that were observed that contained the strange quark. They were found in cosmic rays around 1950. And the other quarks were discovered in accelerators. The most recent such discovery was made at the Tevatron and was made about 10 years ago. The Tevatron discovered the top quark. The Tevatron collides protons and antiprotons with about a TeV in each beam. So I remind you that Rutherford had an MeV, a million electron volts. The quarks, the lightest quarks, their existence was understood with an energy 1,000 times bigger. That was a GeV. And the Tevatron energy is 1,000 times bigger still, which is a TeV. This is what the Tevatron looks like from the air. There are two rings with a circumference of several miles each. And the protons and antiprotons are accelerated around the rings, and then they're made to collide. They're made to collide at two detectors. I'm not quite sure, probably some of those buildings you see on the surface, but I'm not quite sure where in the picture. And here's what it looks like on the ground. There's a flock of buffalo that lives inside one of those rings. So the top quark has a mass such that mc squared is about 175 GeV. It's, in a sense, the smallest known object that we've really discovered experimentally. Its rest energy is almost 200 times the rest energy of the proton, and therefore a few hundred thousand times the rest energy of the electron. It's discovered in a complicated collision. A proton and antiproton come out. The proton and antiproton come in. Out goes a top quark, an anti-top quark, and a lot more stuff. And the top quark and anti-top quark are short-lived. So in turn, they decay to a lot of stuff. And you can only interpret it because of a lot of previous experiments by which the properties of the particle the top quark is decaying to have been explored. And this is actually a picture in the sense of a computer impression of the digital electronic readout from one of the events where the top quark was discovered. So again, the particle beams came in perpendicular to the screen. And the interesting particles come out at right angles, or at large angles, I should say, to the beam. It's been projected. There's a lot of less interesting particles that come out at very small angles from the beam. So there's a lot of debris that comes out of one of these high-energy collisions. But the interesting particles come out at large angles. And the green and yellow lines and so on are just a computer drawing based on a fit to a lot of digital information, which is imperfectly described by the, what you're seeing in white is a very imperfect impression of a lot more data that the digital electronics recorded. But one thing you should see here is that you send in just two particles, and you get out dozens of interesting ones and an even larger number of uninteresting ones that aren't shown. They escaped along the beam in this direction. And you have so many, in part simply because the top quark and anti-top quark each decay to many fragments, which in turn decay to yet more fragments. It's all because of the magic of equivalence of energy and matter. You start with just two incoming particles with a lot of energy, and some of that energy by E equals mc squared goes into creating many new particles, which ultimately enable us to explore better the forces of nature as manifested by the existence of this top quark, which is an important ingredient in our understanding of the fundamental laws describing physics. So I gave earlier, which I think were out of place, a couple other pictures. This is, again, a comparatively simple event that also is scientifically important. It's a candidate for an important particle called the Higgs particle that scientists are searching for. This one is fun because it shows the huge wealth of particles coming out because of E equals mc squared. It doesn't contain as important a scientific lesson as our friend here and this other fellow, which actually show what really important events look like. Now I want to step back and give you a little bit more of an overview of the laws of nature as they've emerged in discoveries made in the 20th century from the accelerators and also from other ways of thinking and doing things. So in the 20th century, we learned that the laws of nature are really very strange when you look closely. So human intuition was relatively adequate before the 20th century. But in the 20th century, we learned how strange the world of physics is when you explore it more deeply. For instance, Einstein taught us that things behave strangely near the speed of light. A rapidly moving object is compressed along its direction of motion. The clock slows down, and all kinds of funny things happen when something is moving near the speed of light. Waves, when you look more closely, are really made of particles. What 19th century physicists understood as light waves are really made out of these tiny quantum particles. Particles, if you look at them closely, have wave-like properties. They don't behave as classical particles. They instead obey the strange and fuzzy laws of quantum mechanics. And according to Einstein's greatest discovery, which is his general theory of relativity, space-time is curved, and gravity results from this curvature. So I've at the top here, I've sketched a picture that's often drawn to suggest that. We imagine a trampoline. The two-dimensional trampoline is meant as an approximation that we can draw and visualize to three-dimensional space. And then this heavy object sitting on the trampoline represents the sun. And the sun bends the trampoline a little bit like, sorry, the ball bends the trampoline a little bit like, according to Einstein, the sun deforms the space around it. And this marble over here represents one of the planets, perhaps the Earth. And if you set the marble moving in the perpendicular direction to that big weight, it'll tend to bend inward toward the central weight because of the way the trampoline is bent, because the trampoline slopes inward as you go inward. So what's really happening, if you look closely, is that the central weight has deformed the trampoline, and that affects the orbit of the marble. But if you don't understand all the details, if you look at it from a distance, if you can only observe the positions, you can't even see the trampoline maybe, then it looks like there's an attractive force from the central mass to the marble. And that's roughly how Einstein interpreted gravity. The sun was deforming and bending the space around it, and that affected the motion of the Earth, which corresponds to the marble. So I've summarized, I tried to boil it down to four or five, but I summarized some of the strangest concepts about physics that emerged in the 20th century. The strange behavior of objects near the speed of light, the particle nature of waves, and the wave nature of particles, and the interpretation of gravity via the curvature of space. Now, the curvature of space is the big exception, but apart from it, and this statement is really the reason that high-energy experiments are important, apart from it, all those other strange laws discovered in the 20th century, relativity, antimatter, quantum mechanics, and all that funny stuff, are everyday facts of life in the world of high-energy elementary particles. To understand the particle collisions at all, you need to understand that the rapidly moving particle decays more slowly when it's near the speed of light because it's like a ticking clock that slows down. You need to understand that its energy increases faster near the speed of light because of Einstein's modification of Newton's laws of mechanics. You certainly need to know about antimatter because matter and antimatter are created all the time, as I showed you in some of those pictures from the particle detectors. And you need to know about the particle nature of light, because it's as particles that the light waves come out of your experiments, and so on and so forth. The high-energy experiments are important in our quest to understand nature, because with that elephant-sized exception of Einstein's laws of gravity, the other strange laws of physics are almost visible in the experiments made at high energies, in the accelerators, or sometimes from naturally occurring high-energy particles. So this is what makes elementary particle physics exciting. It gives us our best window in discovering the strange laws by which our universe works. What we really care about are not the particles themselves, but the laws and principles that describe them, the laws of nature that we uncover by studying the particles. Well, what discoveries can we hope to make in the coming years? To my thinking, the most exciting quest in particle physics for the next few years is the search for something that physicists call supersymmetry. Let's imagine if a physicist who lived 100 years ago were to come back today. Such a person would find that almost everything in our understanding of physics has changed radically. Because of the discovery of quantum mechanics, antimatter, quarks, and hosts of other surprising discoveries that I have not really had time to explain. But there's one key facet of our understanding of physics that has not changed much in the last century. This is our conception of space-time, where we still use the ideas introduced by Einstein. Einstein revolutionized the way we understood space-time. He actually did it twice. With special relativity, in 1905, he did away with Newton's notions of universal time, action at a distance, and the like. He introduced us with a strange new world in which moving bodies shrink, moving clocks slow down, E equals MC squared, and so on. This being in his special theory of relativity, his original theory. And then in the finished product, general relativity, things became stranger still. Mass causes a curvature of space and time, as I told you. A clock slows down in a gravitational field. An accelerating mass emits gravitational waves that travel at the speed of light, and so on. So while most physicists were still trying to digest the special theory, Einstein hit with a double whammy, the general theory, in 1915. And perhaps the strangest, and in some ways the most far-reaching consequences of general relativity, are the black holes, which arise in the collapse of a heavy star, and the ability to understand, at least to some extent, cosmology, the expansion of the universe. But this was essentially all in place by 1915, so it predates quantum mechanics, which took its modern form by 1925. Quantum mechanics, in some ways, changed our understanding of physics even more drastically than Einstein had. It changed almost all of our concepts of physics that existed before 1925. It changed our understanding of what are particles and what are waves, and what we can measure, what the laws of nature allow us to measure, because quantum uncertainty limited that in ways physicists didn't foresee. It was quantum mechanics that taught us that looking closely means going to high energies. It changed almost everything in physics, but the key bit of pre-quantum physics that still survives today in much the same form that it was in 1915 is that the quantum revolution has not yet affected the way we understand space and time. Einstein changed that drastically, but until now, quantum mechanics has not. Many physicists believe that this may change in the next couple of decades, that to make more progress with fundamental physics, we need to understand the quantum nature of space-time. A new theory called supersymmetry has been proposed that may be the beginning of understanding space-time quantum mechanically. In physics, we have objects we measure by numbers: temperature, energy, electric field, and so on. We measure them all by numbers. And then there are stranger quantities, like the spin of an electron, that are really quantum mechanical in nature. They can't be properly measured by numbers. You need non-commuting variables to discover them, to describe them. You need those funny matrices that they may have made you learn about in high school. I remember when our eldest daughter was in high school and they made her learn about matrices. She said, "Dad, what's this? It can't be good for anything." But later she got to college and she learned more math and she even majored in physics and biology. And the time came when she agreed. Matrices were good for quite a lot. And one thing matrices are good for is that you need non-commuting variables, basically the matrices, to describe the quantum mechanical degrees of freedom, the spin of the electron. So we have the objects that you can measure in classical terms, like temperature, energy, and so on. And then we have those inherently quantum mechanical objects that we didn't know about till 1925. So we didn't know about them when Einstein was inventing his theory, but we know about them today. Now, what about space and time? In everyday life, we measure space-time by numbers. It's 3 o'clock, we're 200 meters above sea level, and we're at 40 degrees north latitude, or a little bit farther north here in Waterloo. So that's one bit of common sense that Einstein preserved. He continued to measure space-time positions and times and so on by numbers. He overturned so many ideas that had been considered obvious for millennia. But the idea of measuring space and time by numbers is one bit of common sense that he preserved. He hardly had a choice because quantum mechanics wasn't yet known, so he couldn't use quantum variables to measure space and time. Of course, quantum mechanics was in the process of emerging when he was developing his theory. He even was responsible for some of the key clues that led toward quantum mechanics. But when it emerged with the quantum variables, Einstein went in a different direction and did not rethink general relativity to incorporate such variables. Supersymmetry, however, introduces, apart from the three obvious dimensions of space, up and down, left and right, and forwards and back, as well as the time coordinate that Einstein taught us to think as a fourth space-time coordinate. So apart from the four traditional space-time variables, supersymmetry introduces new quantum dimensions that cannot be measured by numbers. Instead, they're quantum variables, more like the spin of the electron. You have to really take a lot of courses in physics to understand really what the supersymmetric variables are. While the four obvious dimensions of Einstein we perceive in everyday life, and in common sense, we measure them by numbers. 3 o'clock, 200 meters above sea level, and so on. Now, the way we would detect the existence of these new quantum dimensions of space-time is that particles vibrating in the new dimensions would look in our accelerators and detectors like new elementary particles. So what might we learn? Well, I already told you about antimatter. So by those cosmic ray observations, one learned around 1930 that the electron has an antimatter cousin of opposite charge. Another discovery from the 20s is that the electron spins like a tiny quantum magnet. The arrow here is meant to show that it's spinning, in the clockwise direction about that north pole. And then if you turn it upside down, the electron spins in an obvious opposite direction. But there's a catch. I've drawn classical pictures to represent the electron spin, and that's what's not valid. I told you already that the electron spin is really a quantum variable that should be better measured by matrices or quantum non-commuting variables. But since I couldn't draw them, I drew a little ball that was spinning in a classical sense. But anyway, that's the electron as it was explored in the 20s and 30s. It has an antimatter cousin, and it's magnetic. It has an infinitesimal quantum magnetism. If supersymmetry is correct, then the electron has a new cousin, not yet discovered. It's spinless and hence non-magnetic, but it's electrically charged like the electron. I've actually here suggested a positively charged one, but there's also a negatively charged cousin, the S minus. And there are hints from experiments that supersymmetry is correct, but as of yet, there's no decisive proof. While opinions could differ, to me, the most exciting hint of supersymmetry being correct comes from the measured values of the particle, of the strengths of the known particle forces. The weak and strong and electromagnetic forces are observed to be related in a way that has an elegant and natural explanation if supersymmetry is right. And that relation, with the experiments made in the 90s, especially at the LEP accelerator, the E positive minus accelerator in Geneva, that relation was tested at the level of a few tenths of a percent. It works beautifully, and it might be an accident that's tantalizing us, and just the couplings accidentally have those values, but I would like to believe that it means something, that it's a clue that supersymmetry is there, and hopefully that we'll find it one day. So we haven't found it yet. We might find it at Fermilab. That accelerator with the buffalo at the center that I showed you before is now running with more powerful beams, and they have a chance of discovering supersymmetry. But if that doesn't occur, the best chance would be at a new accelerator, the Large Hadron Collider that's being built near Geneva. It'll study proton-proton collisions with an energy of 7 TeV per beam. That's 7,000 times mc squared of a proton, and it's also 7 times the energy of the existing accelerator in Chicago, the one with the buffalo that found the top quarks. And according to most calculations, that'll be enough to produce the new supersymmetric particles if they exist. There's never a money-back guarantee until the experiment is done, but there certainly are hints based on existing experiments and tempting calculations, leading us to hope that this discovery might emerge from the LHC or maybe even from Fermilab. Well, if supersymmetry is indeed discovered, what then? Supersymmetry would modernize Einstein's early theory, which is special relativity, to include quantum mechanics. In special relativity, E equals mc squared, moving objects are flattened, moving clocks slow down. You can't travel faster than the speed of light, but space and time are still flat. And supersymmetry would modernize that theory to include quantum mechanics. But that theory was not Einstein's whole story. He then went on to discover that space-time were curved, that curvature was responsible for gravity, and that all kinds of funny things happen in gravitational fields. So to modernize general relativity to incorporate quantum variables, we need a more far-reaching theory. That's what physicists are looking for in string theory, which is what I'm mostly working on when I'm not giving lectures like this one. But I'll have to leave string theory for another occasion. And I think I'll conclude mostly with a few more pictures. So here's a picture of some of the magnets which are being built for the LHC, the new accelerator near Geneva. To set the scale sitting on top of it, we've got some of the folks working on it. This might look like a lot of magnets, but the diameter of that accelerator is about 20 kilometers at least. So it needs a lot of magnets to fill it up. And this is a picture of a prototype of a magnet, that the accelerating cavity of something called the linear collider. The LHC has the virtue that it's actually being built, and it should operate in 2 or 3 years. The linear collider is a futuristic accelerator that physicists in many countries are interested in. These are prototype magnets that have, accelerating cavities that have been built for it. And the linear collider, if supersymmetry is really there, might someday enable us to get a more precise understanding of the new supersymmetric forces and particles and the quantum dimension of space-time that that would reveal. And I don't like artist conceptions too much, but I'm going to conclude with one more picture, which is an artist conception of a collision at the linear collider. So, by the way, the reason for the linear collider, where I really showed you what an accelerator looked like, it has these round rings. And the advantage of the round ring is that you use the beam over and over again. The particles keep circulating around. A counter-rotating beam is going backwards. And they collide millions of times, or they have millions of chances to collide before you finally, for one reason or another, lose them. So you get to recycle the beam and generate a lot of collisions. It has a drawback that as the particles are bent in that circular beam, they lose energy to radiation. And ultimately, when the energy gets to be too high, it becomes impractical to continue with circular beams. So that's the reason for trying to develop the linear collider, where you can possibly get an even closer look at things by accelerating particles in a straight line in two opposite directions where they meet at the center to energies that you couldn't in practice reach from a circular collider. The drawback is that you can't recycle the beam. And so to get realistic particle collision rates, you need to focus the particles to unbelievable precisions. At any rate, this is a prototype of a magnet that might one day go into such an accelerator. And here's an artist rendition of the collision. Well, I don't like artist renditions too much. I'm showing you this one to just convey to you one more time that in this case, very simple particles come in. The advantage of the linear collider is that it uses simple particles we understand well, like the electron and positron, compared to the very complicated protons that will be used at the LHC, that will be used in the machine with these magnets. These are simple, so you understand the initial state, and that's a big help in understanding what's going on. But because of the magic of E equals mc squared and matter and antimatter creation, very simple particles coming in can produce huge numbers of particles coming out, as the artist has tried to convey here. Well, a realistic collision might have even more of them. So thank you. And perhaps if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer a few.
Well, physicists talk about energy all the time, but what energizes energy?
I'll interpret the question as being what really is energy. So, Newton discovered that in his equations, there was a conserved object. It didn't change in time. And that's what he called energy. And then at a deeper level, 20th century physicists understood, and Einstein inspired a lot of this, but 20th century physicists understood that the reason energy is conserved is that there's a symmetry in nature, which is it doesn't matter when you make the measurements. And conserved quantities, things that don't change, are conjugate to symmetries. When you have a symmetry, there's a corresponding conserved quantity. Unfortunately, I've given you too much of a theoretical physicist's answer. But then there were the other discoveries in the 20th century that taught us that energy is one of the basic coins of the realm. Matter and antimatter, matter can be converted to and from energy, for example.
I have a couple of questions, if that's okay. Okay, first you said that the top quark was heavier than an electron or a proton, but it's smaller, so how does that work? And second, could you maybe go into some detail with Feynman diagrams and how particles split apart into other particles and what exactly that means?
Well, the first question was, is it true, basically, that a heavier particle is smaller? Because it sounds unintuitive. In ordinary life, I mean, if one baseball is heavier than another baseball, it probably means the heavier one is bigger. That's the general trend in ordinary life. I mean, you could have an object of lesser density, but basically, to get something really heavy, it's got to be really big. But in the quantum world, it goes backwards. Because of the way the uncertainty principle works, the heavier objects, in a certain sense, are smaller. And to probe them, you need to look at shorter distances. You need a better microscope to find and study the heavier particle. I can't explain it better than to say that quantum mechanically there's uncertainty between space and energy in such a way that understanding a high energy without too much confusion corresponds to very small space. Now, you could ask, is there a limit to this process? Does it go on forever, where as you get heavier and heavier, you get smaller and smaller? Many theoretical physicists actually believe there probably is a limit, and that it probably involves unifying the forces with gravity, understanding quantum gravity, and perhaps including string theory to understand the relationship properly. But anyway, at the energies we actually reach with the accelerators, the quantum laws keep working, and the higher energies go with the shorter distances. Just remind me a word what the second question was. Hard without a blackboard to explain what a Feynman diagram is. But a Feynman diagram is the way Feynman visualized a history of particles coming in, branching and rejoining, and then going off. And while you can draw a pretty picture, what really made it work was that Feynman endowed the pictures with mathematical rules that explain how you do the calculation. There's a modern version of that in string theory, where the pictures are modernized and the rules are also modernized in an extremely beautiful way. So on another occasion, had I been lecturing on string theory, I would have explained the Feynman diagrams and how they're modified in string theory. But I think for today, we'll have to resist going down that direction very far.
I'd like to ask, since the LHC is going to be the new wonder toy for everybody, since you only got one, how are you guys going to make sure, what other predictions may be outside of it, are you going to have to make sure that your theories are on track? Because it's quite easy, of course, for people to see what they want to see.
I think what you're really asking is how you can be sure that the experiments get it right. If an experimenter observes something, how can you be sure they didn't make a mistake? There's an incredible level of professionalism in those experiments. And they cross and recheck things in an incredible number of ways. And the standard of proof that's regarded as necessary before you can make a claim is incredibly high. I'm constantly chuckle when I see in the newspapers a polling company that reports what they found about public opinion. I can tell you that the standard of evidence that they have about whatever they say public opinion is wouldn't get you to first base in terms of making a claim about a physics observation. Beyond that, though, I've got one more bit of good news about the LHC, which is that there actually are two detectors. There's one accelerator. It's 20 kilometers in circumference. But there are two places in that big ring where the beams are made to collide, and detectors are operating. The detectors have been designed by different teams of physicists, and the details of their design are different. They're competing designs and techniques. But they ultimately have very competing capabilities. Some will be a little bit better for one measurement than for another. But you can bet they'll be checking and competing with each other. You've asked, though, a very good question, frankly, because as experiments get more and more important, more and more expensive, there's a huge benefit in having competing experiments. but at what point can you still afford it? Right now, for example, in the last few years, there are important experiments that have been done in Japan and in California checking the relationship between matter and antimatter, which is believed to be very important in how anything emerged from the Big Bang rather than just radiation, and how matter survived the Big Bang, and ultimately while we're here. And it's obvious to me looking at it that it's been a big boon to them having two competing groups, because when they disagree, you can bet it gives them an extra incentive to get it right, to figure out what's wrong and why their observations disagree. But it's also obviously very expensive to be doing those experiments in both California and Japan. And we're talking about experiments that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. So I feel it's a perplexing question, the need to balance what's achievable against the benefits of competition. This question doesn't only arise in the areas of physics I'm telling you about. For example, in astronomy, more and more important observations are made from satellites, and those are extremely expensive, often one of a kind operations, and you have to make sure you get it right.
Thanks for a wonderful lecture. And my question is basically, when you quantize things like photons, you can get an analogy like colors related to energy and that kind of thing.
Yes.
If you quantize space-time in your supersymmetry, are there any ideas about what kinds of things mere mortals like us can relate to say, ah, now I get it?
Well, what makes it hard, it's like trying to really properly explain the spin of the electron. So supersymmetry, assuming we have the good fortune of finding it, and it definitely comes with no money-back guarantee, but supersymmetry would incorporate in space-time these infinitesimal quantum variables in addition to the ordinary dimensions that we experience. So I can talk about it, and I can try to describe it a little bit. I could try to explain why it's important and how we have some clues about it. I did a little bit of that in the talk, and perhaps I might have done a little bit more. But ultimately, to really understand it, since it is quantum mechanical in nature, there's no substitute for learning about the quantum variables and ultimately the relativistic quantum theories and how supersymmetry fits in. It's not that different from a lot of other things, though. The newspapers print a pretty picture of how the WMAP satellite made these fantastic measurements of the fact that the temperature of the universe is slightly different in different directions, teaching us about the probably about the origin of galaxies and a lot about how the universe came to be. You can appreciate the picture to some extent, like you can appreciate, I hope, what I told you about quantum variables in space-time. But to really fully understand either of them, you really have to delve into the physics theories.
I had a question actually about string theory. I've heard critics of string theory claim that it can't produce a single observable experimental result, and therefore it's more of a philosophy than a theoretical physics. I'm just curious how you would respond to those critics.
Well, one partial answer was implicit in my lecture, but I didn't spell it out. Supersymmetry, the concept of supersymmetry, emerged at least historically from string theory. It's a slightly complicated history, which I'll oversimplify to be brief. But supersymmetry was an inevitable consequence of string theory, because string theory just doesn't work without supersymmetry. And that has a lot to do with how humans conceived the whole concept of supersymmetry. So if supersymmetry were to be confirmed at accelerators, that would give string theory a tremendous boost. Speaking personally, I've spent close to half of the last 30 years studying supersymmetric theories. So it would really be nice if it was shown that supersymmetry is relevant to nature. Now, I have to acknowledge that string theory is an even more wonderful theory and is even more far-reaching in its content and its implications. And that being so, while the discovery of supersymmetry would vindicate some of our efforts, it would leave the rest of our work unvindicated. And so we will have to think of new and better ideas.
Elaborate a bit more on the concept of the spinless particle. If it is not spinning, what exactly is it doing? And does it mean that...
Well, the spinless one is round. In a way, it's easier to understand this. The spinless one always looks the same from all directions. It's the guy with spin that's harder to understand because the spin is quantum mechanical. So, in a sense, before I told you the electron was spinning, you didn't assume it was spinning, you probably assumed it wasn't spinning. And that was a better fit for the particle we haven't discovered but hope to discover at the LHC than for the actual electron that we really know about, which has this crazy quantum mechanical spin.
One of the predictions of supersymmetry was that there would be an electron that didn't have a spin. And one of the things I was wondering about is, would that electron have the same mass as a normal electron? If not, why would you call it an electron? And if it does have the same mass, why wouldn't it have been discovered with current energy levels?
Well, it's a good question. I didn't actually call it an electron. I called it a cousin or partner of the electron. In the ideal world with unbroken supersymmetry, it would have the same mass as the electron. And in the, but you see, to understand it properly, I should have given you another lecture on the weak interactions. I actually kind of gave the lecture today as a physics colloquium at Toronto. But one of the most important lessons in physics in the last 30 or 40 years, which I didn't have time to explain, was something called symmetry breaking, where nature as we observe it doesn't have all the symmetry of the laws. And one fundamental aspect of that is that we see light with our eyes, but to discover the weak interactions takes 20th century equipment, even though the basic laws treat them in exactly the same way. A process of symmetry breaking occurred. I'm almost tempted to open up the other talk and find a few pictures where I explained it, but it might take too much fumbling. But a process of symmetry breaking occurred whereby, even though at the fundamental level, the photon, the W and Z are equivalent and should have had the same mass, and that would have been the case at very high temperatures in the early universe, in the world as we live in it now, which is frozen down to a less symmetrical state at low energies, which has one virtue, which is that we can live here, the photon, the W and Z are no longer exactly the same. The equations treat them the same, but the vacuum doesn't, to give you the jargon. And the conjecture is that there's a similar story for supersymmetry, but of course, until we find it, we won't know if that's true.
These are probably totally different things, but you mentioned the sort of quantumized extra dimensions in supersymmetry. Are those extra dimensions in any way connected with the kind of extra dimensions they talk about in string theory?
Well, string theory actually gives rise both to the infinitesimal quantum fermionic. The technical term is fermionic. I just avoided it in my lecture. String theory gives rise to both fermionic dimensions, and also, at least in the simplest interpretation of string theory, it gives rise to new bosonic dimensions. It's like the guy who asked what is prose. Well, you've been speaking prose all your life. So bosonic variables are ordinary variables you measure with numbers. It's the fermionic variables that you don't know about if you haven't studied physics at the university. So string theory gives rise to both of them. And the fermionic extra dimensions we might actually discover at the accelerator. There's a chance that we could discover bosonic extra dimensions at the accelerator, but I thought the chance was enough smaller that I didn't go into it in the lecture, even though it would be even more exciting, actually. The quick answer to your question is that string theory is something physicists stumbled into without understanding it. Einstein, before he invented general relativity, developed the ideas it was based on, and then he developed the theory it was based on, that was based on it. So by the time he had the theory, he knew exactly what it was. String theory, instead, had its first manifestations in accidental discoveries made in the late 60s, and it's led to a fantastically, unbelievably rich series of discoveries in the 35 years since then. I can't possibly do justice to it, even in a whole lecture, let alone in answering a question. But when string theory was developed, it's repeatedly proved to know things that humans barely have a glimmering of. And that's actually one of the main things that convinces me it's probably on the right track. But two of the things that happened when string theory was developed was that it required supersymmetry, which we're looking for at the accelerators. And we actually have hints of it experimentally from the values of the particle couplings. And it also required the new bosonic or ordinary extra dimensions. And when they came on the scene, physicists said, "What's that?" and didn't like it very much. But 10 years later, in the 80s, it was discovered that the new extra dimensions gave room for trying to unify the forces. There are a lot of particles and forces we know about experimentally, and Einstein dreamed of unifying them, but it's extremely perplexing how so many funny pieces could possibly fit together in a unified picture. And there was something uncanny that came out of a surprising calculation done in 1984, where suddenly it proved possible, using the extra room given by the extra dimensions, to unify the forces with each other and with gravity in a way that was startlingly close to being realistic, as well as startlingly, I wish I could pronounce this word, startlingly elegant. That's another aspect of what convinces me that this must be on the right track. So many amazingly discoveries of which no one had any inkling of have been found. Such a rich source of ideas that has so much influenced our understanding of the standard physical laws, as well as influencing our understanding of geometry purely from a mathematical point of view. I don't think humans are clever enough to think of those old ideas, so I must conclude that it's the theory that knows about them, presumably not by accident. I'm reminded, in fact, of the exploration of the fossils that was made starting in the early 19th century. One interpretation of the fossils were that they were evidence and traces of life that had existed in the past, while another interpretation of the fossils were that they were placed in the rocks at the creation of the universe to test our understanding. So I suppose it's conceivable that the incredibly rich structure that physicists have now been studying for 30 odd years and has given birth to so many unexpected discoveries that influenced our thinking in so many areas of physics and math, I suppose it's conceivable that that's an accident. But it's not what I tend to believe.
Feynman once asked, what is this thing called a human that looks at itself in the mirror? What is this thing called a human? Atoms with curiosity that looks at itself in the mirror and yes. Wonders why it wonders.
Yes.
And I wonder if in your investigations, you've come across anything with implications towards understanding what we are and specifically what consciousness is, the thing that's making meaning out of all these particles. And is it a dimension? Is it a force? Do you have any speculation on that?
I certainly don't have any novel thoughts to offer. I entirely agree with Feynman's observation that the laws of nature, as we've explored them, especially in the last century, are surprising and amazing. And one of the most amazing things about them is that in their solutions, they describe thinking creatures who ask about the universe. And it's probably true that the Schrodinger equation for electrons and nuclei is an adequate approximation to the laws of nature to describe us, but that's a pretty surprising fact. When you just write down the equations, it's pretty hard to know that among their solutions are creatures capable of discovering those equations.
You were talking about how when particles are accelerated and bombarded by each other, I think it was top quarks come off and other stuff.
Yes.
Are there any practical applications that we know of that result from that acceleration?
Accelerators at lower energies are used for all kinds of practical applications. For example, radiation therapy. And lots of things that are now in hospitals started from particle physics, like MRIs. Well, it started from quantum physics. It was just at the period when quantum physics and particle physics were branching off, just in the post-war era. So even the internet, it partially came about because particle physicists at the CERN laboratory in Europe had vast amounts of data that they were trying to transmit around the world. A success like the internet has many fathers, but definitely part of the history was the way particle physicists were trying to grapple with all that data. And accelerating technology is used in old-fashioned television sets, as I told you, although it's in the process probably of becoming obsolete for these flat panel displays that involve other aspects of condensed matter physics. At the highest energies, though, where we're seeking to discover supersymmetry, we're not mainly aiming for practical applications. We're aiming for understanding of the universe. A better analogy would be to an astronomical satellite. So if astronomers launch a satellite that's able to take a picture of the very early universe and detect ripples that were there shortly after the Big Bang that explain the origins of galaxies, I think people are really interested in it. Professional scientists are certainly interested, but so are many other people. If physicists discover a new quantum dimension of space-time, I think many people will be interested in that as well. It enriches our understanding of the universe.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.